Israel is marking this week the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. It's a really big deal. There are dozens of world leaders coming in, kings and presidents and prime ministers. Even in Jerusalem today, the bus stops have electronic signs saying that later in the week, the buses will not be running on schedule. Because of all of the world leaders that are going to be here, there are going to be roads closed. It's going to be difficult to get around. People are just better off staying at home. But thinking about this event, which in theory at least is very momentous, the 75th anniversary of the end of the concentration camps, I think it would be better to use that terminology than to talk about the liberation of Auschwitz, because I'm not really sure that Auschwitz has been liberated. liberation demands two different factors, two different elements. One of those elements is the fact that there are liberators, and on the other side you have to have those who are being liberated. Today around the world, we're seeing huge amounts, if that's the proper word, of anti-Semitism. The anti-Semitism that's perhaps been under the surface for so long is today bubbling over. And it's something that's appearing throughout the world. It's happening in the United States. It's happening in Europe. You're seeing violence used against Jews. You're seeing not only violent acts, but very, very violent words coming out, particularly from some of the more extremist Islamic elements, whether they be in Iran, whether they be here, in the so-called Palestinian Authority, where time and time again we hear about the necessity to kill Jews. Even this week, a columnist in a PA official newspaper, Al-Hayat al-Jadida, wrote about how one assassination would lead to the end of the events this week here. In other words, they're suggesting that somebody go out and kill one of the world leaders as soon as they arrive, and then everybody else will run back home. So it's true that back then in 1945, there were soldiers who went into the camps and freed the Jews who were there, as well as the others that were being held captive and being tortured and starved and mass murdered. But a lot of what Auschwitz was is not just past. It still is. So maybe today we don't have the same kind of concentration camps, but the thoughts and the ideas that brought them to fruition and prevented the Allied forces, primarily led by Roosevelt, United States, from doing anything about it. And today, it's documented that they all knew exactly what was going on, but they preferred not to to do anything that might stop the killing. So that's one side of it. That's the side of the liberators. The question is, though, about the liberated. And I'm not sure that we were really liberated. You know, there are two sides, at least two sides to such things. Or perhaps not just when we're talking about the Holocaust, but there's a level of a practical level, a physical level, and there's a spiritual level. Physically, the Jews were allowed to leave Auschwitz and the other concentration camps, but I'm not sure that spiritually they've been liberated, that we've liberated ourselves. We started to back in 1948 with the declaration of the Jewish State of Israel. But since then, we've continued to see over the years, up until today, literally today, that people, Israelis, as well as Jews outside of Israel, still do not recognize who they are, what they are, why they are, and we're still held captive by the thoughts, the ideas, the spiritual level that sunk so low during 2,000 years of exile. And there's no other way to put it. There's still a lot of that exile, the spiritual exile, flowing through our bodies or our minds, and in perhaps some cases on some level of our souls. Today it was suggested that perhaps within the next week or so a vote will be taken in the Knesset dealing with granting sovereignty over the Jordan Valley. One of the members of the infamous Kohol Levan, Blue and White Party, said that, as a matter of fact, number 13 on the list, a woman named Yael Gelman, said that, who belongs to Yair Lapid's party, so I guess it's really no surprise that she says what she says, except that she is considered to be one of the leaders, and one of the more influential people within the Blue and White Party, saying that they're not talking about sovereignty, but they're talking about another one-sided expulsion, as they did in Gush Katif, throughout Judea and Samaria, and probably also the Jordan Valley. That is so totally preposterous, just the idea, when you have, even tonight, these explosive balloon bombs that are being sent over from Gaza into Israel, and usually they're landing in areas around the Gaza Strip, in Sderot and some of the Moshavim there. But one of them made it tonight as far as Beit Shemesh, which is right outside of Jerusalem. You have people that were given land for free, and they're still shooting rockets at us from the land that we gave them. When they don't want to shoot rockets, they send over these kind of drone-like things made of balloons with explosive devices on them. And we have people within the Israeli political leadership who are talking about doing this again in Judea and Samaria and the Jordan Valley, which means that they will be so much closer to Tel Aviv and to Haifa and to Beersheba and to Jerusalem and to all of the other cities in Israel. It's mind-boggling. It's very difficult to not only to accept, but to even ponder. I mean, it really, really does not make any sense. And that's the Jews in Israel. Unfortunately, the Jews outside of Israel are even worse shape, because many of them don't know that really that Judaism exists. They don't know that Israel exists. They don't see any purpose behind the state of Israel. The assimilation numbers today in the United States are well over 50%. There are numbers that go up to 60 and 70% in the assimilation rates. Most American Jews have never made it to the state of Israel. They've never visited here. And I'm not talking about visiting Hebron. I'm talking about visiting Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And people under the ages of 40 do not see Israel as one of the priorities to consider when they're trying to figure out who to vote for in a national election. And this means that, very simply put, and very harshly put, and very sadly put, is that a lot of Auschwitz is still within us. In other words, we're still being held captive by the thoughts and ideas that are totally foreign to our essence, as was Auschwitz. Auschwitz was it was dichotomous, it was totally opposed and opposite of anything and everything that Judaism is, because Judaism is about life and Auschwitz was about death. But when you fail to understand who you are, what you are, and why you are, then basically you're facing the same kinds of issues. It's just called self-destruct. And even worse than that is that even if people try to forget, whether they consciously try to forget or whether they just don't know to begin with, we're still seeing the same results as happened in Nazi Germany, and that is that the Nazis would refuse to allow Jews to forget that they were Jewish. So that you had a person who was one quarter Jewish and might not even be considered religiously by religious Judaism, by Orthodox Judaism, to be Jewish. As far as the Nazis were concerned, they were Jewish and they were sent to the camps like everybody else. And this is going to continue as it already is, be it in the United States or in France or in England or in Scandinavia or anywhere else. A Jew is a Jew is a Jew, and we can try to forget who we are. Our neighbors won't let us forget. And it's very sad that this should be the wake-up call. Why shouldn't we be able to live as we really are of our own free volition, and not because somebody else is sticking pins in you, or worse, and saying, don't forget who you are. If you forget who you are, we're going to remind you. We're going to wake you up. The problem is that the way they wake you up, you wake up dead, because that's what they want. And we're seeing this, we're witness to this, and I consider it to be very, very sad. So I'm really not sure whether the terminology of celebrating, or not celebrating, that's the wrong word, marking the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz is really proper terminology, because I'm not really sure that we're really, really liberated. We have to work very hard. We have to wake ourselves up. People that have already woken up have to try to shake the others out of their deep sleep. In some cases, people are comatose. In some cases, people are even far beyond that. But we have seen, and we are witness to the fact that even a people that has been brought to, literally brought to ashes, has been able to come back to life. That's what we did. We did come back to life. We came out of the ashes in the ovens of Auschwitz, and we were able to renew, bring about the rebirth of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. But now that we're here, and now that we have a state, we have to keep it. We have to maintain it. We cannot let it just fade away, nor can we give it away. Because if we do continue to attempt to rid ourselves of our land, then it's only going to ricochet back and hurt us very much. And all of what we try to rid ourselves of, we will eventually have to take back, not necessarily because people say they want it, because they won't have any choice. Because either you live there and you control it, or your enemies utilize it to try to do what Hitler tried to do, and that is to annihilate the Jewish people, and especially those Jewish people that are living here in the state of Israel. So I think perhaps that these kinds of thoughts should be running through our hearts and our minds and our souls this week, as we mark the 75th anniversary of the opening of the camps and the freeing of the Jews in the camps. But I think we have to think very, very seriously about whether or not we really are liberated or not. The death of Oslo. So last night, we were all witness to the speeches made by Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. It was
obviously a very emotional event, and I think it could also be defined as a very historic event, and I think that it also can be labeled as a very confusing event. It's historic because for the first time the legitimacy of the Jewish people in Judea and Samaria has finally been recognized. And as I've said in the past, we don't need anybody's stamp of approval. We know it belongs to us. But the time has finally arrived when the United States of America also realizes that we have a place here. Maybe they don't recognize all of the land, but they recognize a good part of it. And that's a very good beginning. It was very emotional because both of the leaders understood that what was happening has never happened in the past, and if it didn't happen now, I don't know when it might happen in the future. It's a big lift for Netanyahu before the elections, and I think it's also a big lift for Trump, because probably the most important population in the United States that gave him a victory 3 years ago were the evangelical Christians. And last night, Pastor John Hagee was at the event, and it's obvious that they are very much in favor of the recognition of the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria. Netanyahu very specifically, very notedly, mentioned Hebron and Maarat Machpelah. He mentioned Shiloh, he mentioned Bet El. It's nice to hear a prime minister of Israel reciting the names of these biblical cities, which today are again populated by Jews, especially because we've heard many other particularly Christian leaders who have spoken about these places. And it's always the Israelis that tend to leave them out. So I think it's significant that Netanyahu did mention them, and I think that it also shows that he has no intentions of leaving any of these areas, as he also said quite specifically. However, it was also a very confusing event. It's left people scratching their heads. On the one hand, there's a recognition of 30% of Judea and Samaria as belonging to the Jewish people, recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, a recognition that terror cannot continue, but Trump's plan and his speech last night also definitively mentioned a Palestinian state, and so-called Palestinian rule over most of the rest of Judea and Samaria. If we have 30%, then that means they've got 70%. And a lot of people really don't know where to go with all of this, because on the one hand, as Amit Segel, the very astute commentator, right-wing, religious Israeli commentator, and you don't have too many of them around with all of those particular criteria, he said this is the first time where Israel has received something and is giving back words, whereas usually we get the words and they got the land. This time it was reversed. And of course, that's very, very important. But how do we deal with the possibility of a Palestinian state? And how do we deal with the possibility of losing 70% of land, which we really do understand and believe belongs to us? In any kind of a deal, there's always some kind of give and take. There's some kind of compromise. It's a very, very kind of a bitter bullet to try to bite into. My personal feelings are that it will never happen. We can go back any number of times. Perhaps the most well-known refusal of the Arab world to recognize a Jewish entity back when the United Nations decided on a partition plan on November 29th, 1947. the Israeli leadership at the time, led by David Ben-Gurion, did not like the partition plan because it didn't leave us a whole lot of land for a state, but he accepted it. The Arabs, on the other hand, rejected it and declared war. And this is what has happened continuously and continually since then, particularly with the offers made by Ehud Barak and later Ehud Olmert for tremendous amounts of land, more than 70%. Arafat and later Abu Mazen were offered over 90% of Judea and Samaria, with, of course, Jews being expelled from their homes and in many of the Jewish communities, such as here in Hebron and others, and they refused to accept it. The conditions laid down by the Trump plan for the recognition of a Palestinian state include the disarming of Gaza and Hamas, which is something that is not going to happen, not tomorrow, next year, and not 4 years from now. If there are elections in the Palestinian Authority here in Judea and Samaria, then there's a very good chance that Hamas could win those elections the same way they did down in Gaza. The Trump plan also calls for the complete stoppage of monies being supplied to the families of terrorists who have killed Jews. Palestinian Authority has numerous times said that they will never do that. Abu Mazen has made that one of his standout points, that they will continue to pay the families of terrorists, and anybody, any Arab who commits a terrorist attack knows that his family is going to be quite well off, and if he lives through it, he also, for the time that he spends in an Israeli jail, will be paid large amounts of money, much more than any of them could ever make working. So it makes it worth their while to try to kill Jews. One of the other points that was mentioned is they have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. This, too, they refuse to do. And there are other points also. If these conditions are not met, then a Palestinian state will never, ever come into being. And the chances of Abu Mazen accepting these conditions are less than none. And any of his possible successors will also refuse to accept these conditions, if for no other reason, because any Arab leader in Judea and Samaria who accepted those conditions would find himself dead very, very shortly, very quickly. He would, without any doubt, be killed because of the Arab-Muslim extremism that we have to live with here every day. Continues to be very, very dominant in this area, and I do not see any possibility whatsoever for a Palestinian state to be formed or for any of the land that is called to be transferred to them in the Trump plan to ever happen. The plan itself is considered to, Trump has laid down 4 years for it to be implemented. And my guess is that after 4 years, if it's not implemented, in other words, if the Arabs don't accept the conditions that have been laid out, and there is no real negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, then we'll be able to do anything we want to do. And for the time being, we're going to declare sovereignty on all of the communities, the Jewish communities throughout Judea and Samaria. That's no small feat. However, I think probably the most important element, which hasn't been mentioned too much, there are a few people that have spoken of it, but not enough. And that is that this plan, as proposed by the United States, is quite literally the death of Oslo. Oslo was one of the most dangerous, damaging programs ever to come into the history of the world. It did tremendous damage to the state of Israel. It brought about the murders of over 2,000 Jews, and has created innumerable problems and issues that we've had to deal with since the signing of the Oslo Accords and their implementation starting back in 1993. And finally, after all of these years, this program, this plan, this so-called peace plan has finally been dead and buried. It no longer exists. Anybody that thought that Oslo might be able to be brought back to life, at this point, the greatest superpower in the world has declared Oslo to be dead. And that is very, very, very important. We will never, ever, ever be able to go back to any kind of a plan which calls for basically the destruction of the State of Israel. Something that that Rabin accepted, Shimon Peres pushed, and unfortunately they started to implement it. And the terror that it brought is something that no Israeli who lived through it will ever forget. And my hope is that the history books that come out over the coming decades will recall the massive catastrophe of what is called Oslo. It should be remembered as a curse on Israel, a curse on the Jewish people, a curse on the Torah of Israel, and it's something that will never, ever be repeated. So, despite the confusion, despite the lack of understanding exactly what we should do and we shouldn't do, the first and foremost idea is that Oslo is dead. And for that, I think we have to thank Donald Trump, and we will have to remember him as being a person who killed Oslo. Donald Trump, thank you.